It's a bear. It's a bear. It's a bear.
It's a bear.
It's a bear. It's a bear.
It's a bear.
It's a bear.
It's a bear.
It's a bear.
It's a bear in a cage.
In a cage is a bear. What's he doing in there?
Locked inside, no room to play on this lovely summer day.
It's a bear.
It's a bear.
It's a bear.
Why do they have him locked inside?
It's a bear.
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 It's a bear in a cage.
The official Midsommar Bear in a Cage. Now available on shop.a24films.com. Not compatible with other games, including Skin the Fool from A24.
So we're just going to ignore the bear then?
It's a bear.
Welcome to Two Old Farts Talk Sci-Fi. I'm David Plink.
And I'm Troy Harkin, and you definitely heard a little clip of Bear in the Cage, because we're going to be talking Midsommar, right, David?
Yep. This is our folk horror installment, part two, Midsommar episode. Recording it on Thursday, May 5th, 2022, is scheduled for broadcast on Saturday, May 28th. We do have a special guest for this episode. Sandra Casturi is joining us. She was our special guest for part one that looked at the 1973 movie The Wicker Man. And she was also our guest for the Ray Bradbury episode about Something Wicked This Way Comes from season one. Before that, Troy will give us a spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert! Spoiler alert!
Thanks, Troy. Thanks, Troy. We are recording this session via Zoom. As we mentioned in our folk horror part one episode, Troy and I have known Sandra for many years. We will not be repeating her bio here. Please find it online at our website and in our folk horror part one episode. Welcome, Sandra.
Hello. It's nice to be talking about this one of my favorite movies.
Two Old Farts Talk Sci-Fi is a look back to when we fell in love with the speculative genre to recall these times with fondness and affection. I think a review by Lepidopterus on IMDb posted 9th of July 2019 titled An Operatic Catharsis on Emotional Dependency may have said it best when it said, Astor taps into a dark and vulnerable place. He opens a door to chests you may have locked away and have had no intention of coming back to. If you've gone through a breakup recently, it may resonate even stronger. It's uncomfortable, unpleasant, but ultimately cathartic. On to Midsommar. Troy Harkin will give some background, set it in context before we get into a full discussion on it. Take it away, Troy.
Well, I just wanted to reiterate some of the things that we said about folk horror in our previous episode. And basically, we were saying folk horror. God, folk horror is so scary with all the stabby and the little pitchforky thing that you hold. I mean, it's not a spoon. It's folk horror. No, it's actually folk horror. Sorry. Folk horror explores fears of folk, old folks. Fuck, sorry. I will take David, enjoy your drink because I'm going to have to take this again. Maybe we should just keep it all, right?
No, okay. I think you should keep it all.
I would keep it all because
this is comedy gold.
Okay.
this is horror. This is our horror.
Yes, true horror. True horror. Okay. Sorry. Okay. You know, folk horror has some definite trademark elements. It does. We can see the juxtaposition of the prosaic and the uncanny. You know, you get your power of ritual, you get pagan conspiracies, you get rural locations, And often the stories are set outside of modernity, meaning, you know, way back timeies. Midsommar was written and directed by Ari Aster. It was released in 2019 and was the follow-up to his highly acclaimed debut feature film, Hereditary. Aster, who was hugely influenced by Swedish film legend Ingmar Bergman, was approached by Swedish producers to create a slasher film involving Swedish folk traditions. The director had recently dealt with the trauma of a breakup and found he could work through his pain by dealing with it in his screenplay for Midsommar. The film began filming immediately following the release of Hereditary. Shot in Hungary, outside of Budapest, not Sweden, the Horgan village was constructed from scratch for the film. The film stars Florence Pugh as Danny Arder, Jack Rayner as her boyfriend Christian. Midsommar opens on a dark winter night in the northern United States where Danny is beside herself as she attempts to contact her parents and her bipolar sister, who has been sending Danny ominous emails. Danny reaches out to her boyfriend Christian, who downplays the incident. Soon, Danny learns that her sister has killed herself as well as her parents by filling their home with carbon monoxide. Much later, a grieving Danny finds that Christian and his three friends, Jack, played by Will Poulter, Josh, and Pelle, all of them anthropology students, are planning on visiting the Swedish community, the Harga, that Pelle belongs to. Christian has been keeping the trip a secret from Danny. Christian reluctantly invites her to come along, believing she will not want to go, but she does. The five Americans make the trip to the rustic village and are welcomed into the community by the Hargans. We soon discover that the community is not as idyllic as it seemed. After witnessing the ritualistic senicide from atop the Atastupa cliff, some of the party are extremely distraught, including Danny, who is still trying to deal with the loss of her parents and sister. The visitors are kept drugged and manipulated by their hosts for their own needs. Ari Aster has said, for the American men in the film, Midsommar is very much a folk horror tale. But for Danny, it is more a wish fulfillment fairy tale. Few films demand repeat viewings in the way that Midsommar does. The artwork through the film gives us hints as to where we are headed. In fact, the entire plot of the film is illustrated for us in a single folk mosaic in the opening shot of the film. Fewer horror films take place almost exclusively in the daylight. The film was released theatrically on July 3rd, 2019, with a running time of 148 minutes. A 171-minute director's cut was released into theaters less than 2 months after this initial release. Midsommar was made for $9 million and has grossed $48 million. Time Out's Joshua Rothkopf wrote, "A savage yet evolved slice of Swedish folk horror, Ari Aster's hallucinatory follow-up to Hereditary proves him a horror director with no peer." According to Rotten Tomatoes, they say, "Ambitious, impressively crafted, and above all, unsettling, Midsommar further proves writer-director Ari Aster is a horror auteur to be reckoned with." And I was saying just a moment ago that Ari Aster somewhat jokingly has referred to the film as The Wizard of Oz for perverts. And you can figure that one out once you've seen it. That's it, David.
Thanks a lot, Troy, for that explanation. And sometimes we ask about, you know, how did you first see the film and what was your first reactions, and if you have any story behind your first viewing. And Sandra is just wondering if you have any story you want to share.
Yeah, I'll tell you about how first. I should point out that I'm wearing my Midsommar headdress right now, with antlers and flowers as a tribute to this film. I saw the film in the theater. We had seen Hereditary, which I absolutely loved. And so when we heard that Ari Aster was doing a new film, definitely wanted to see it. And I think I saw a trailer of it, and it looked like visually, it looked completely unlike Hereditary, which is quite a dark palette. And this was so bright. And then, of course, what I found hilarious is that because half my heritage is Estonian, and, you know, we like things like dancing around the maypole and bonfires and wearing tops with a lot of handmade embroidery on them and this sort of thing, and maybe slightly less murdery. So it was quite fascinating because there's some cultural similarities there that I was quite drawn to, and then saw it in the theater. And I think, you know, that first moment of shock, well, you know, spoiler alert, presumably people have seen this by now, when the old couple jump off the cliff like that, because you know something's coming. I mean, Ari Aster has talked about the fact that he doesn't think that there are any actual surprises in the film, that you pretty much know where it's going. It's a surprise to the people who are experiencing it, but not to the audience. But still, there are shocking moments in that movie. And I think from that absolutely shocking moment, because that tension, that dread is building up. Because, I mean, he sets the stage, of course, right at the beginning with Danny's sister's suicide and murder of, the parents, that you know that this is not a real happy film. And then he also has the painting at the start, which tells you exactly how it's going to go, which is such a handy little benchmark. So it completely blew my mind. I had to watch it several times. And then was speaking to my good friend Hallie Villegas, who then said it was the funniest movie she'd seen in years. And I thought, really? This is a comedy? This is a funny film? And, you know, in many ways it is. So you can agree or dispute it. Maybe it's like all great films are, they wear many faces for everybody.
Yeah, there are definitely moments where, you know, laughable moments, let's call them.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll probably touch on some of those. Yeah, like you, Sandra, I went to Hereditary almost not wanting to like it, because I don't know if you recall this, but the hype at the time that A24 put out there was that it was this generation's The Exorcist. That was the line. And in fact, that's what's on the DVD case as well, that quote. And, you know, that's a little bit like the line, oh, this is the new Beatles, you know?
I don't like it when people tell me how I'm supposed to feel about a thing. So yeah. I did find that off-putting too, and was just kind of like, ugh, it's going to suck.
Right.
And then, of course, loved it.
Yeah. Same here. Like, you know, I mean, I don't see comparisons in many ways to The Exorcist.
Oh, but, no, not at all. But, not at all.
What I did love, well, I mean, everything about the film, but the audience's reaction. Now, we're talking about Hereditary here, first of all. And it was great because there were so many, like young, like, you know, teenage girls who you could tell they wanted a typical horror film. And they were like saying, like, you could hear them turning to each other and saying, what the fuck is happening? And that's what I love about Ari Aster. It's very much often like seeing a Lynch film. And it does create that. And I love that. And like you say, it not only rewards repeated viewing, but almost demands it. Which is nice. You know, I don't think that's a problem. I don't want my films to feel like the cinematic version of fast food. and Ari Aster does not give us that. So anyway, saw Hereditary, and I was like, oh Jesus, give me more of that. Mm-hmm. I must say, I did love Toni Collette's performance. Like, I still wish Toni Collette had been nominated for an Oscar. I think it's a shame she wasn't.
Well, that film, and Midsommar, what they both do, what Ari Aster does really, really well, is the language of discomfort. Just like that, every moment in both of those films is full of discomfort, and it makes the audience uncomfortable, because you feel like you're participating in their drama and you don't want to be. And it's like you were accidentally sucked into their living room or into the little village, and you're just like, I am not part of this. I don't want to participate in, well, I mean, the emotional stuff in it, like
the
female relationships or the family dynamic or whatever. In both of those films, everything is so uncomfortable all the time. And
yes.
I think he does that so well.
You know, something that was pointed out to me in terms of Midsommar is Danny never being allowed to properly grieve and never being allowed to basically have a catharsis until the end of the film. Yeah. And it's true, because every time we see her crying, either there's a cut and they, like, through the filmmaking, like, don't allow her to have that moment. Or we see her with Christian, her boyfriend, and he's like catatonic basically while she's, you know, crying her eyes out.
She's in the bathroom, on the plane with a hand over her own mouth.
Right. Right.
And so she's stifling herself too.
Yes. And it's not until the very end of the film where she's allowed catharsis and allowed to express the relief.
What I found fascinating is how Astor plays with the audience with respect to who you're supposed to feel sympathy or empathy for, because again, like, Christian is kind of a dick, but Danny is so passive aggressive and irritating. And she's like, no, you should
totally
go to Sweden. It's my fault. Yeah. It's totally. Yeah. You should go. No, you should absolutely go. Like, yeah, no, you go to the party. It's fine. Or, you know, maybe I'll come too. And it's like, oh, it's maddening. And so you absolutely understand his irritation with her and his desire to get away and just have some time just on his own, not even to necessarily go off and fuck some Swedish girls, but just like some peace and quiet. But of course, her parents and sister just died. He can't break up with her now. And again, it's the
trap—the
trap of that kind of, like, how long is a decent interval to wait before you ditch the person whose family just died horribly?
Yeah.
And I mean, there's no good answer.
And clearly, like, we've all seen people like this or been in those relationships where
I've done time in a couple of those.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, it really rings true. And it's nice that it's not like super combative and, you know, over the top in terms of the dysfunction of that relationship. And you see people who sometimes go through entire life living that dysfunction.
It's interesting that Will Poulter, who is right now starring in Hugh Laurie's version of Agatha Christie's Why Didn't They Ask Evans, which is an absolutely delightful version. He is, of course, what's his character's name? Is he Josh? Or I forget their names.
I have it for you.
He, of course, later is given the jester's hat and the fool. And
Mark.
He is, of course, Mark, of course, he is the fool, because he, even before he's, you know, decapitated and given the jester's hat, because he's the one telling the truth. He's the one telling the truth to Christian, going, when are you going to dump her? This is terrible. This isn't working out. And he's telling the truth about.
Well, he has no filter. That's right. No filter at all.
No filter. He's just telling it like it is. And of course, is well rewarded for that at the end.
That's right. Like, you know, he's just concerned about, will there be babes there?
Yeah, babes. Oh, I'm going to piss on the sacred tree. Oh, was I not supposed to do that? Sorry, man.
I'm high. Everybody do what I'm doing. You have to. Yeah. And, a new person. I don't want a new person here.
Yeah, that's right.
So you were recently introduced to the film, right, David?
Yeah, just for the podcast and the folk horror, I just had not seen it, wasn't even aware of it. This is quite the introduction, the Wicker Man and Midsummer, which might also be maybe not the best first date film. But there is something about the film, like the whole early part, with the parents and the sister, just how it's shot right up to the garage door opening, the relationships between Danny and the rest of the group, even like she's got the boyfriend and his reaction, how they're relating to each other and what she's going through. And you've got the other buddies who are, and just the actual acting, what they're saying, how they're reacting to each other, and the whole scenes seem so real, because this is Ari Aster, who is going through a breakup, putting all of this angst and all of this uncomfortable feeling, but real and true. So you feel like you've seen this before, and you believe every moment. This reminds me of a bit about The Wicker Man, where there's a certain point where you have to trust yourself and what you believe in, your instincts. The point that I made in the earlier Folk Horror episode about
Sergeant Howie going out to the boat and the seaplane and realizing that it's not starting, and therefore he should realize that there's that he's in danger. One of the tropes in horror is if you get up in the morning and you see that one of your party is not there, and you start asking around, they say, oh, well, they had some emergency or quick thing that they had to go to, and they had to go to the station, but they just didn't feel that they wanted to get you up to let you know that they needed to go, and whatever extensive reasoning and whatever it is, the first thing you should realize is that they're full of shit and yeah, that your friend is dead.
Exactly.
Those are the two things.
Nobody ever wants to believe that. I mean, and again, Wicker Man and Midsommar are both about the surety of belief in different ways. You know, Howie has his religion and the belief in his own authority. And here, like Dani has the belief in her relationship and in the way the world works. But you have that beautiful visual cue as they are driving through Sweden. And just before they get to where they get out of the cars, the camera actually turns upside down and it looks like they're driving in the sky. Mm-hmm. And it's actually Ari Aster, like, literally telling you the world has now turned on its head. So none of the old rules apply. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just such a, like, it's such a tongue in cheek and kind of hilarious way to do that, because it's like, see what I'm doing?
It just
cracked me up all over again.
And that would be if we're, you know, using the Wizard of Oz analogy, that I guess is when they're arriving in Oz, right? That's the where everything changes.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
There was one other thing I wanted to jump into before I let you guys take this film to its natural ending. Is there's a wonderful scene. Now, it's a bit odd because there is, of course, the important scene of what I guess you call the senicide, like when, and hopefully we're not giving away too much. We've already done the
spoiler alert. Yeah.
The spoiler alert. But there is a scene where these older people do get thrown off a cliff or jump off a cliff willingly or what have you. Now, And then the reaction of this, like the scene is just so amazing. And then the reaction to it. And then there was one of these older people from the community mentioning to, I guess, Pelle or whoever it is that's trying to bring them and all this. Well, I thought you would prepare them or that they knew about this. And he said that he thought he had. Now, this is the scene where he believes that he prepared them. Josh says, you know, why they're mentioning about ages, and he says, why 36? And Pelle says, well, we think of life like the seasons. Mm-hmm. So you're a child until you're 18, and that's spring. And then at some point, we all do our pilgrimage, which is between 18 and 36, and that's summer. Then from 36 to 54, we're working age, which is fall. And then finally, from 54 to 72, you become a mentor. And then Dani says, what happens at 72? Oh, yeah. So Pelle makes a comical throat slash gesture and Dani laughs. Now, this is what Pelle believes his explanation that this has prepared them, that this is actually
but
what
I
happened.
Told you.
I told you by doing this comical gesture of me throwing me.
And the thing is, Josh knows, like, because Josh is the hardcore anthropology student, right? So he actually knows. And Christian, who you get the impression all through his life will kind of be a fuck off doing things half-heartedly, does not know. You know, and he wants Josh to tell him.
All right. Beauty rest. Tomorrow's a big day.
What's tomorrow?
First of the big ceremonies. At the stupa.
What's that?
It's too hard to explain. You'll get a better sense tomorrow.
Wait, seriously? You can't just tell me now? Wait, you're not talking about an actual one.
I mean, it's pretty actual.
Fuck. Do you know what it is? Dude.
Is it scary? That is so fucking annoying.
The other interesting thing about that scene for me, because, you know, when I rewatched it just the other day, now this has got, I don't know, this is the fourth, fifth time I've seen this, is that the outsiders who are watching this, when the woman jumps off the cliff first, and then there's that awful shock, and like they are quite close up with some of that, and it's really quite gory. You have like Danny, like grabbing, like Christian's just standing there, of course, like a dim bulb. He doesn't think that covered anybody, but he's in shock too. Let's give him benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
She slaps her hand onto his arm, like in shock. But watch her face. Like everybody else is like, oh my God, oh, and they're all upset and they're crying. But she's just like, she's holding his arm, but she's just standing there. She's riveted. And it's her expression on her face is a little bit opaque, because you don't, and this is where Florence Pugh is such a great actress. Mm. Like you don't really know what she's thinking, because you think she's shocked and horrified by what has happened. But I don't know that she is. I think that's the moment of revelation for her, that is where things start to turn and how her power starts to come back, even though she may not realize it herself at that time. But I was fascinated by that everyone else is like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And she's just standing there and she's still. And of course, she's upset later. That's mm-hmm. where she sort of goes back to her former self. But that moment, like, it's almost like everything is pivoting around her in that scene, even though the really ferocious action is happening with the people coming off the cliff.
Yeah, no, you're right. That's very well said.
Well, the scene also, like that's whole scene. I mean, the and you're absolutely right, Sandra, that this whole cultural thing and what's going on. When the second one goes over and they're not, and it's not entirely dead or mostly dead, you know, like, yeah. I'm not dead.
Yeah.
And bring out your dead. And then you see the two people with the big hammers.
Yes, the mallet.
That was, for me, the moment the film became real to me, like the whole moment of horror that these people are going to go there to finish this off. Because sometimes when someone does drop off that clip and hits whatever it is, they don't, you know, they're still somehow alive.
Yeah, they don't
alive.
Die right away.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a little more brutal than Logan's Run carousel.
Not a tidy death at all. Like, just
and when the second guy doesn't, I guess, swan dive when he goes feet first.
Yeah.
Like, you know right away. It's like, don't do that.
No. Head first. Go head first.
Or face first. Yeah,
face first. It's just nicer for you in the end. Note to self, if we're there in our 70s in Sweden, look out for this sort of thing.
Yeah, the jumping off the cliff is supposed to achieve one thing, and that's death.
Yeah.
So do it right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and also the hammers come back later, which I had a feeling that they might. But go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, as a little note, supposedly they created, there was a really, I guess, special effect done for the head that gets hit with the mallet, mm-hmm. where it's a fully formed skull. And then when the mallet hits it, clearly it collapses, but it was able to reconstitute itself so that they could do it repeatedly. But that amazes me that they could create this thing that could collapse, and then if they needed to do more takes, it would like just rebuild itself.
Wow.
And they would hit it again.
That's kind of amazing.
Yeah, that is the scene where I felt like I have never seen anything like this in film. You know, it wasn't built up as like with suspense, these deaths. It was clearly brilliantly lit. Yet one of the most horrific things I've ever seen in a film.
Yeah, that's the other thing. That's very true, that he doesn't use any of the usual musical cues you get in horror movies to signal to you what's going to happen. You don't get that at all in this movie. So
no.
Thrown into it without any preparation.
And he said, actually, that was one of the most difficult things with the score, because most of the score, or a lot of it, is, I guess, diegetic, right? Diegetic, non-diegetic. Diegetic, it's part of the story space. You actually, like, when you hear that music of the flutes playing as they're walking along the path, to the village.
Oh, and then the camera goes
and over then you the see the musicians, yeah. And most of the music in it is that.
It's like Monty Python, where it's like, Robin ran away. I didn't.
Yeah. But I guess my point was he didn't want to give too many cues musically. And he said it was really difficult for them composing the final scene. Which I guess we can spoil because we're going to do that, but we go from this sort of open-endedness of this horrific moment, like 17 minutes or so of a horrific moment, and then we see Florence Pugh's character have her catharsis. Mm-hmm. And as how did he word it? It's her wish fulfillment fairy tale. It's not her folk horror story at this point. And so it was difficult transitioning from the horror of everybody being burned to her having this beautiful sort of rebirth in her Oz.
Well, it's the rising of the phoenix out of the ashes in a way, literally and figuratively. But one thing I did want to mention, you guys were talking about how it's such a bright movie and because it's in the sunshine, of course, Sweden, much like in Estonia in the summer, you have those white nights where the sun just dips slightly below the horizon and it's never really dark. It reminded me of one of the other, because you don't really get horror movies that visually look like this. And the one that it reminded me of was Carter Smith's The Ruins, which is set in Mexico on that old temple. And that entire film, almost that entire film, is in the bright sunshine. And it's absolutely horrific as well. If you haven't seen that, it's great. And the book it's based on by Scott Smith, who did A Simple Plan, the book is also absolutely terrific. Although the book, I think, is much grimmer or slightly more grim than the film is. But again, that bright sunshine, which seems so antithetical to horror, but there it is. It works perfectly.
Ari Aster talked about the difficulties of shooting outdoors in the sun and how, as he was writing the script, it didn't really dawn on him until he was forced to actually shoot these scenes and realized that, this scene is a long scene, and so that's going to take a day's worth of shooting, yet I can't allow for the sun moving, which it does constantly. That's the nature of the planets. I can't imagine how difficult that would have been to cheat those scenes and to shoot with the sun constantly moving. I mean, unless you were going to do it like faux documentary, which he doesn't. It's a very detailed shoot. I feel for him.
He could have shot it with the sun in different places just to add to our sense of disorientation and also to let us know that maybe we are in a kind of supernatural space. Oh. Which again, you're not, like with Wicker Man, there aren't really moments of the supernatural, but it's implied. And of course, you know, everybody's fucked up on drugs half the time. So, you know, the way those flowers in the May Queen headdress are breathing and which is also very much like The Ruins. It's fascinating because I was watching, because there are moments in that film, I particularly noticed that on this rewatch, where I was going, is that a glitch in the film? Or, oh, no, okay. That's on purpose. I think that's not my TV or.
Oh, and it's really wild on a big screen. I fell in love with it. I think it
fucks you up visually.
Yeah, and when they first have that first high, where she does she see the grass in her hand? I think so at that point. But the tree behind her, it's just moving, coursing. You know, it looks like a river. It was gorgeous. If it's okay, I wanted to go back to some of the things we were saying about humor in the film. Supposedly, when he did the premiere for Swedes, they were like, oh, we love Austin Powers. And they love that reference to, oh, the children are watching Austin Powers.
Yeah, baby.
That was a great little moment.
Funny moment, you know, because it was like, what the fuck? Did he just throw that in? It's like, okay, we're just going to do that. How great was Will Poulter as Jack the Fool?
Yes, he's wonderful. He's like I just like him. You know what? It's interesting. I didn't actually know that he was British until I saw him. Yeah, and Why Did They Ask Evans? And that's when I realized. Oh,
well, I think three of the four leads or the students are not American.
Yeah, because Florence Pugh is British, I think.
That's right, and Christian is Irish. Is Will he? Poulter's British. Yep.
Well, yep. That makes sense. He's a ginger.
Yeah, that's right. He was great in Bandersnatch, the Black Mirror Bandersnatch.
I have
he's
not
been seen everything that. I have seen him in. He's been great in, and he's one of those.
Yeah. Quick sidebar question, because I was wondering this because again, I wasn't. What Midsommar does is it makes you not trust your own senses, which I think is great because there are moments in that film where it feels like Christian's eyes sort of get bigger or more almost, and they seem to not quite. Same as, so I was just like, wait, is that happening? Like, because it's subtle at first. And then later you're like, oh, I think this is hallucinatory now.
Yeah. There's a point too, where his mouth starts to spread and he almost gets like a Cheshire Cat thing going on. But that was another one of those freaky deaky things. I also love the point too. It's kind of funny where, Danny's about to win the dance off and she starts thinking that she's speaking Swedish.
Yes, that was so great.
And she's just speaking gibberish. It's like, oh, I can say it now.
We understand each other. That was great.
Yeah, of course, Christian's face while copulating in the ritual. We talked about that.
Oh, so funny and awful.
Oh, and one moment that like did crack me up, even though it's like we're getting down to the nitty gritty of the film in the third act and the ritual. But just the fact that the elders have sort of like what looks like a Powerball or a bingo set up, you know, with the ball.
Yes. It's like the red ball or the black ball and Minority Report, you know, like it has that same feeling of thing. But just here's the bear painting that with a little girl and the bear, what I found I realized is that I have a very similar work of art done by Eric Orchard, which which is a little girl with a giant bear, and this is based on a poem that I wrote, and of course I read a lot of fairy tale things. So it really does seem like I'm very connected to this movie, both like culturally and mythologically.
Definitely. I think, you know, when we finish this episode, we should all go out and play Skin the Fool.
Yeah, baby.
You know, just how in some cases unlikable or how they're getting like one of the characters thinks that his idea of doing a graduate thesis is being stolen by another of the characters. Cause I guess they're all interested in this culture and doing what they're doing at points, you know, that, you know, these are kind of the rules, you know, like, in Screen, the movie Screen, they had so much fun saying, well, you don't go to the kitchen to get a beer because now you're going to, and they play up.
Don't say I'll be right back. And
because the thing is where he says, oh, can I take photos of this book? And they say, no. Now we all know watching this film that this guy's going to go back later at night and try to take photos of that.
Yeah, but they kind of know that too, and I mean that's the trap and the temptation is that they're being told not to transgress, but they're being kind of invited to transgress at the same time.
And I love the when they're having the dinner scene after Mark pisses on the elder log, and he says, you know. That dude, look at, he's like staring at me. Is he going to kill me? It's like, yeah, he's going to kill you. He's fucking going to kill you.
Yeah. Again, he knows the truth, you know, even when he doesn't exactly know it.
Yeah. And then he's so willing to like, sort of what you said, David, like he should know better in a way, right? If he was like one of the characters from Scream, he would know better.
Yeah.
But he's just like, oh, she's going to show me the thing. You know, it's like, and as long as he thinks he might be getting pussy, he's going.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. He's being led down the garden path by Little Red Riding Hood in a way that Little Red Riding Hood is the wolf in this scenario. Or Midsummer is a pastoral. It's Le Déjeuner sur l'herbe.
Oh, I think I just saw your floral headdress move.
Cellophane flowers of yellow and green towering over your head. Look for the girl with a sun in her eyes. And she's gone!
Oh, one thing I was going to say, just if we're sort of doing comparisons between Wicker Man and Midsummer, is Troy, I read that article you sent to the Louis Scheuer's article in Film Magazine, and he says in that Sergeant Howie in Wicker Man is thrown off kilter by his search for the missing Rowan, but that in Midsummer, Danny is already in turmoil. But that's one thing I actually kind of disagree with, because I think that both characters are clinging to reason by their fingernails. It's just you don't see it as much in Howie because he has a better front, whereas in Danny you see that she's on the emotional the emotional edge. But I think Howie is as well. He's just hiding it better.
That's right. And you know, I wanted to mention there's a scene. I'm trying to remember when this is. I think it's before the dance off, before she becomes the May Queen, but maybe it isn't. No, I think it must be just after she becomes May Queen and people are coming up to her. And we actually see her mother pass by her.
Yes, that's right.
Or I guess we're seeing through her eyes. She sees her mother pass by her.
Yeah.
You know, and that's obviously her feeling like this is home. This is where I want to be.
Well, I may have to see it a few more times because I just didn't understand the ending. Like, they've got all of the friends and almost everyone is dead. It's almost like one of those standard horror films or even Alien. Like who is going to be left by the end of it?
Right. She's the last girl. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. She's the final girl. Yeah.
Yeah. But I didn't think like the idea of her being the May Queen and her getting what she wants. That all sounds to me like she's going to survive this, but I didn't, from watching the film, I didn't think she was. Like, I thought that she was, whether it's a sacrifice or whatever it was, that she's not going to survive this.
I thought that too at first. The first time I saw it, especially when she became May Queen, I thought, oh no, because there is a whole tradition of sacrificing the Summer Queen or the May Queen. You know, or for the harvest, depending on which time of year it is. So I thought, oh shit, she's gonna go. But in a way, she is sacrificed. Her old self is sacrificed.
Yes,
and she's reborn.
Yeah, and you can see, I think, Pelle's overtures towards her are authentic, and you know, it's almost like bringing her here, which was the most essential thing, is him finding a way to give her home. And, you know, because he spells that out a few times. Like, I think he says, does Christian feel like home?
Yes.
And it's, yes. No, he you clearly doesn't.
You
feel
like you were being held.
Held, yes, yeah. Yep.
Oh my God, that's, because I was almost thinking his character reminds me of one of the characters in the movie Taken, who actually meets up people and then he ends up deciding that, oh, this would be a perfect person to kidnap, and is sort of a front and pretends to be someone that you might like or get to know.
Oh,
and
then right.
And all that kind of, like, this guy sounds like he's the person who's gone and these are his friends. He said, well, maybe my friends could be the sacrifice of my
right
group that I'm a part of, and maybe that's what this guy does every year or so, whatever it is. He's out there doing this.
Yeah.
But he's quite sincere in his wanting Danny there.
Right.
And I mean, presumably she stays there because they are a small community, and they even say quite obviously that, you know, they have to breed with outsiders occasionally in order to, you know, not get too inbred.
And this particular festival is only once every 90 years too. Yes. So it's not something that somebody
sacrifice all the time.
Yep. And there was also another point. Well, we also sort of said how, you know, if we're going with the Wizard of Oz and Pele is her wizard, and, in, you know, unlike the original film, when he teaches the lesson that there's no place like home, well, this is not you going back from Oz to home. This is like, no, this is your home now. And there is a little bit of dialogue. David, I hope I'm not being redundant here. I think this is the conversation Sandra and I had during our break earlier. But when they're driving from the airport, Pele says something about how the bike, oh, if somebody says, why are the best looking girls here in Sweden? Mm-hmm. And or why are they all so hot, is how Will Poulter's character Mark says. And Pele says, well, because the Vikings took all the best looking ones and brought them back to Sweden. And that's exactly what he's doing with her. Not that she's necessarily the best looking one, but that's what's going on here.
Yeah. Yeah. He found the one for him, and eventually down the road, I guess they'll be the old couple jumping off the cliff when they're in their 70s, I suppose.
Yeah.
I was also thinking, I thought a little bit about this with Wicker Man as well. Of course, the names where, you know, all the, you know, Rowan, Willow, yeah, the tree and plant names. And I mean, Rowan, of course, is a magical tree with magical properties. But here, too,
Meadow.
Meadow. If you think about the Wizard of Oz thing, if Christian is the Cowardly Lion, I mean, his name is Christian. So in a way, he's sort of the avatar of, you know, I guess a Judeo-Christian faith. You could look at it that way, which is kind of in a Wicker Man parallel. But then you have Danny.
Throwing Christians to the lions?
Yeah, Danny, Daniel in the lion's den, which she kind of is. And her last name is Ardor, of course, which is love, lust, passion. So I find that quite kind of, it's like it's his cheeky little nod to that.
Yeah. Now here's something interesting, like thinking back to Wicker Man as well. As Lord Summerisle has everybody gathered in the town before they start to do their procession, they're not in costume yet, he says something about the god of the sun, and he refers to him as Nuarda. And I went through, like I Googled it, and I Googled it, did various spellings. I Googled it as New Arda. I looked in Fraser's Golden Bough. I could not find anything. So I don't know if they made that up, but I thought it was interesting that her last name is Ardor, and they're talking about this new Arda. So I don't know if there's a connection. If anybody knows, please let us know. We would love to know.
Dreamcasting. Yeah. Dreamcasting, baby.
As they say on the poster, let the festivities begin.
Did you want to throw anything out for this, Sandra?
Yeah, sure. I mean, again, even more than with Wicker Man, I don't think I would not even dreamcast this. I don't know who else could possibly be in that would give you exactly the same effect. I would say, like, the most wacky, if we're doing a Schrodinger's cast, the cast of the Wizard of Oz, of course.
Oh, fuck yes.
And or in fact, throw in the cast of the Wicker Man. I mean, I think that would be kind of hilarious.
So Willow is Danny, or is that Howie?
No, I would say, yeah, it would have to be Willow. Danny is Willow. Christian is Howie. Lord Summerisle is Pele.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, I was fairly new to Florence Pugh. I now have seen a lot of her things and love everything she's been in. It's going to be great to, you know, live at least a couple more decades and watch her work.
I loved her in Little Drummer Girl, the series. I thought that was great.
Yeah. But I confused her at first for Chloe Grace Moretz. And so I thought, well, maybe it could be her, or because I now know about the whole love of Bergman films, I thought Bibi Anderson, who was Ingmar Bergman's frequent female lead in films like Persona, Wild Strawberries, and The Seventh Seal. So I figured, you know, you get the whole blonde look going. So I'd be happy with either of those as Chloe Grace Moretz or Bibi Anderson. Christian, I thought that was Chris Pratt at first. So I'm going to go with Chris Pratt of Guardians of the Galaxy, and he would give the best fuck face
for sure. Yeah.
Pele, I thought a young Jeff Bridges, like King Kong era, or even earlier, like Thunderbolt and Lightfoot, but when he has sort of like the dude, the Big Lebowski hair, but is a younger man. And also he's got
All odds era.
He's got a very kind face, so I thought he'd make a good Pele. David, did you have anything for dream casting?
The only thing I was thinking of, and it may not be the best one, is I was looking at 2019 films, and the highest grossing, or the probably the best one of the year, was Joker. And I was almost thinking, can we somehow fit Joaquin Phoenix somehow into this film? But then he would be the one taking out the entire village, and he would end up being king at the end of the film. So it'd be a very different film.
Yeah,
if he was might
work
somehow
better as Lord Summerisle, actually.
Yeah.
So he would be Lord Summerisle, but I'm not sure if I can quite work him in. It'd be very easy to be able to have the earlier, the X-Men First Class kind of characters in this, because I was almost thinking of Pele of Wilhelm Blomgren's as Pele, that could be one of the like the entire cast, like there's such a young cast that I was thinking almost that X-Men First Class, if you just look at the characters that appeared in that film.
Mm-hmm.
And try to say, well,
a good almost cast. Any of James them. McAvoy and
yes,
yeah,
I was thinking of James McAvoy more for Pele, and then
Michael Fassbender.
Yes, yeah. It's just such a strong. I mean, it's just in this cast too, so it's just almost interchangeable. You can almost take anyone from that and just put them in to this one. I can't remember the actress's name in the X-Men. Was she the one that was in Hunger Games?
Jennifer Lawrence
would be, for me, could be Dani, because Jennifer Lawrence I think is excellent.
Yeah, I thought about her.
Yeah, that's actually a good choice.
So Schrodinger's cast, I wasn't stumped, but I went a certain route, and that is Pele kept reminding me of somebody, the actor Wilhelm Blomgren. And I realized who it was, and he looks to me like a very young David Crosby, the musician. And so I thought, well, if Pele is David Crosby, then I have to go with like other Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young people. So Danny, I thought, would be great. Joni Mitchell, who was a gal pal of all of those guys.
Right.
So yeah, Joni Mitchell would be Danny, and Christian would be Stephen Stills. And then I thought Joni Mitchell and CSNY soundtrack. Imagine that laugh Joni does at the end of Big Yellow Taxi as Christian is burning inside of the bear carcass. That's my Schrodinger's cast for Midsommar.
Oh, you're going to be shocked by my one, because I've just pulled this right out of my butt, so to speak. But I thought Pele could be actually the soccer player Pele.
Oh, no.
Honestly, David.
So you have Pele there. So obviously Christian has got to be Beckham, David Beckham.
And what's your name? Sinclair would be...
Well, you could, but I was thinking with Beckham, why not have the actress from Bend It Like Beckham, Keira Knightley.
Oh, okay.
As that's Danny. Good.
There you go.
I was trying to combine.
This has been a beautiful exercise in stream of consciousness.
Yeah.
Well, I was almost thinking that I was.
Have you been having the mushroom tea?
Yes. Yeah. I'm having the bubble tea.
But yeah. Just don't have the tea that looks pink.
Yeah, don't have that because somebody's pubic hair is in their menstrual blood or something.
Well, my explanations almost sound like I'm on The Masked Singer and I'm the person who says, I know exactly who this person is.
Oh, yes. There's this absolutely wonderful poem by Ian Duhigg. Duhigg, D-U-H-I-G. You can just Google it, called The Lammas Hireling, which he won the Poetry Society UK's really big prize for, which is like £5,000. It's amazing. And he won with that poem, and that is very much about magical doings and I think you'll see the connection if you watch it. And it has the wonderful phrase, which I didn't know what that meant, of course, to go into the hare, which means witchcraft, because, of course, witches turned themselves into hares. And, of course, you have hares showing up in Wicker Man. There's, you know, the theme of the hare. And I thought that people would enjoy reading that poem. So go check that out. The Lammas Hireling by Ian Duhigg.
And as a quick sort of tie into everything folk horror, I was just wondering, Sandra, do you have any others you just want to mention, folk horror films that you love that
point
out to people?
If you liked Midsommar and Wicker Man, I would highly recommend Apostle with Dan Stevens of Downton Abbey fame and also of The Stranger and a whole bunch of and Legion, a bunch of other things. And I think that is on Netflix or on Prime right now, or at least it was. And that's also a guy going to an island with a fucked up cult looking for his missing sister. So yeah. It's got lots of horrible, violent things. So basically, don't go to an island. I think this is the thing. Do not go to an island. Avoid cults, you know. And the other movie I would recommend, if you can find it, it's an Estonian film from 1968 called Libahunt, which mm-hmm. means werewolf, and based on a play by August Ginsberg. And it's again has the a lot of wonderful folk mythology, like if you jump over the midsummer bonfire without getting singed, it means you're a werewolf.
Yeah,
telling you.
And remember, as Lord Summerisle says, don't wear clothes. You know, when you're jumping over fire, that's just dangerous.
Right.
I have three quickies. Not a great film, but I still love it. Children of the Corn, the original.
Oh, yeah.
Made for something like $800,000 and it grossed $14 million. So there's no surprise that they made 9 dreadful sequels or spinoffs or whatever.
I have never seen any of the sequels. I've only ever seen the original.
Ritual.
And we still have to do our Corn episode at some point.
That's right. Yeah. Ritual, which is on Netflix. It's a Netflix original.
That's I like the film. The book is even better.
Great. And one of those three that was mentioned as being, one of the best British horror films of that era, Blood on Satan's Claw. I watched it a couple of times since sort of, being tipped off on it. It's really good.
I have never seen that. I will have to watch that.
And it is on, I believe, Tubi. It's on some free streaming thing. That's why I've watched it twice. I think it was on Tubi. Are we putting this one to bed? I guess the garden bed, David?
Yeah, I think so. That's our folk horror part two, the Midsummer episode. Thanks to our special guest, Sandra Kasturi. Thanks a lot, Sandra, for being our guest.
Thank you so much for having me again. It's always a great time talking to you guys.
Remember to catch us on all our socials. Your favorite podcast provider will get you here, hopefully. Our website is 2of.ca. That's numeric 2. On Twitter, we're at 2numeric2, Old Farts Sci-Fi. Facebook, we're 2OldFarts Talk Sci-Fi. Please tell a friend. Please like and subscribe.
I am David Klink.
And I'm Troy Harkin.
See you all for our next episode of Two Old Farts
Talk Sci-Fi.
there is something, I don't know if you have already got a plan on what you might be using as your opening clip, but any comments on it?
Well, it's about a bear, and it's about a cage, and it's about a bear in a cage.
Troy, you like the whole thing as one big unit, so to speak. Sorry, that came out of my mouth.